Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath Debbie Brooke, with Dr. Adil Chimsanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community. I'm Debbie Brooke, your host, and we will have Dr. Adil on the line with us shortly. Today is October 10th, 2012. This is show number 39, and Dr. Adil belongs to a fourth generation of the reputed family of the Chimsanawalas, who have always been devoted to the service of homeopathy for over 105 years. We're going to be discussing today the topic of dropsy, but first we're going to talk about some celebrations. Yes, and honorary discussion about some of the masters of homeopathy. And we have Dr. Adil with us on the line today.
Hi, how are you?
Hello, I am fine, and I have opened the chat line, so we do have a guest who has already joined us to listen in to these educational talks. If anybody needs homeopathic care, you know where to call Dr. Adil. And also, what we talk about is educational, informative only. You do not practice homeopathy on your own unless you are experienced. So
exactly.
we're going to begin today, and I'll let you get started.
Yeah, so as you correctly said, that today, the 10th of October, we have got two solvers whose death anniversaries are there. One is Dr. Franz Hartmann, and the second one is Dr. Herbert Robert. Dr. Franz Hartmann was born on 18th of May 1796, and he died on 10th October 1853. This gentleman, I mean, a single word can describe this gentleman, the life of this gentleman, and that is struggle. He came from a very poor family, and in his early life, he had to struggle against poverty. And he was born on 18th of May, the year, 1796, the year of birth of homeopathy. And as a young boy, he was very keen and intelligent. In 1810, at the early age of 14 years, he went to study theology in a grammar school and also started giving tuitions to poor children. But soon, Hartmann wanted to become a physician. So he went to Leipzig in 1814 at the age of 18 years. There he met Dr. Christian Gottlob Karl Hornburg, who had also left theology for medicine. So they both used to stay at the same room, and they followed Hahnemann right till the end.
Was he a colleague of Hahnemann?
They were students. They became students because these people, I mean, particularly Dr. Franz Hartmann was born on 18th of May 1796, when Hahnemann discovered homeopathy or made homeopathy known to the world. So he was quite junior to Hahnemann. Ultimately, his homeopathic activities earned him the anger of allopaths. Thinking that this may be hindering his degree, Hartmann, after 2.5 years, on 19 September 1817, went to Berlin. But soon he came back to Leipzig at the commencement of his long holidays. And on March 21st, 1819, he received his medical diploma in Jena. It would be of interest to note that this was a year in which Dr. Hornberg's medicine was confiscated. So his partner's medicine degree was confiscated, because at that time many people were deadly against homeopathy. And these two zealous people, Hornberg and Franz Hartmann, they stood by their principles and ultimately contributed their might to homeopathy. He has written many books, of which the few is, one is Practical Experience in the Domain of Homeopathy, Part 1, The Use of Nux Vomica in the Disease According to Homeopathic Principles. A second very important book he wrote was on, it was in 1830, it was published, Dietetics for Everybody. The third was Dietetics for the Sick. In 1831 and 32, he wrote Therapy of Acute Diseases, which goes in two volumes. I mean, people who really like homeopathy, who have explored homeopathy, should go and read this book, Therapy of Acute Diseases by Dr. Franz Hartmann. I don't think many people do publish this, but whenever you can lay hands on this book, it's a very good book, and you can really solve acute diseases still being in complete principles of homeopathy. So it's a two-volume book. And he was also the co-editor of a magazine called as Allgemeine Homöopathische Zeitung. I don't know I'm spelling it correctly or I'm pronouncing correctly. But that journal, I don't know it's published again still or I don't know. And in 1852, he wrote the final book, Diseases of Children and the Treatment According to Homeopathic System. So, a lot of books have been written by this gentleman, and this gentleman died at 9 a.m. on 10th October 1853, and he had got what we are going to discuss today, and that is hydrothorax. He had got tuberculosis, which ultimately landed in dropsy as hydrothorax, and he died. He left this heavenly abode.
I see. And so it's very interesting to hear you say that he talked about, he wrote these books, Dietetics for Everybody and Dietetics for the Sick. And yeah, it seems as if nutrition, even, is that what he is talking about? Dietetics meaning nutrition and proper eating habits and what is healthy.
Exactly. I mean, from that day onwards, the role of dietetics, Hahnemann has mentioned many times in at many places about the role of diet. But this gentleman has actually elaborated in two separate volumes, for being healthy one, and second sick people. How, with homeopathic medicines, you should follow diet. It's a small book. I mean, actually, it's a booklet of hardly, say, about 30 to 40 pages. But it's worth reading a book. I mean, it's really good. I mean,
Do you have this book?
Have read it long back. I don't have it book. I have this book, but I could lay my hands on. But and the book which I discussed earlier, the acute diseases one, Therapy of Acute Diseases. Again, that is a book worth reading. Two volumes. I have again read that, and but I don't possess them.
Okay. All right, so we have today something special on our show page, is a link to the PDF documentation for today's show notes, and that will help guide us through the program today.
The second gentleman, which we do remember and is very famous, and many people would not know about Dr. Franz Hartmann, but if you are connected to homeopathy in any form, you should know about Dr. Herbert Roberts, a well-known name in the world of homeopathic philosophy. And over many years, even today till now, Dr. Roberts' articles are universally popular and they are unanimously accepted, and they're read for their scholarly exposition. And the ideas which he has put forth of homeopathic philosophy and practice. This gentleman was born on 7th May 1868 in Riverton, Connecticut. His primary education, he went to Winsted and completed his graduation in 1886 from Winsted High School. And then he decided to take homeopathy as his career. And he took admission in New York Homeopathic Medical College, from where he did his matriculation in 1892 and completed his degree in 1896. And it was in 1896 itself, he started his medical practice in Brattleboro in Vermont. He practiced there for 3 years as a successful practitioner, and but unfortunately he had to close his clinics for some reasons. And then he shifted on to Deroy, Connecticut, and there he completely practiced till the end of his days. He became a member of the Connecticut Homeopathic Medical Society after starting his practice in Shelton, and became the president of the society for 2 years, later elected as secretary, and retained this position for more than 30 years. Dr. Roberts, as everyone knows, he has wonderful writings, study of remedies by comparison, the rheumatic remedies, Sensation as If, again a must read. People who have not read this book, Sensation as If, they are missing something. And last, everyone must have read, that is The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, a very, very popular book in amongst homeopaths, whom we refer left, right and center. Of course, this gentleman again left us on 13th of October 1950, and we really salute this great philosopher and ideal follower of homeopathy. He died in Brattleboro in Vermont. So, hats off the two solid pillars of homeopathy, Dr. Franz Hartmann and Dr. Herbert Roberts.
Well, thank you for introducing the listeners to two masters of homeopathy from our history who provided a foundation for which we are indebted. I am sitting here with the Sensations as If book right in front of me. And last week, I read on the show a wonderful hour of one of his articles, kind of an introduction of his theory and philosophy about vaccinations. And I encourage people to go back to last week's show in the archives and take a look at that.
Okay. I have got two or three questions just now. One is, I'll go only one because the subject of dropsy is quite interesting. And actually, I delivered to one of our postgraduate schools, and that's why I've got it prepared. And I found it quite interesting, having discussed everything about dropsy since we have the rubric here. But before we go on to this rubric, let me complete one question, which is pending for quite a long time. And that is asked by Dr. Sanjay from Raipur. And he says, Dr. Adil, can we allow the use of antipyretics, allopathic antipyretics, in cases of fever? Now, Sanjay, basically, fever is one of the defense mechanisms of the body. As you also must be knowing, since you are a doctor yourself, it's a vital method to maintain the internal milieu or the internal harmony of the body. Hence, the artificial reduction of fever needs some thought, whether you do it by homeopathy or by allopathy or whatever methods. Yes, patients do frequently come to us with the hope of getting the fever reduced immediately. But whether or not one should do it depends upon the justification of the event. A physician of any school should view fever as mentioned above. At the same time, one should be aware if it is accompanied with other complications, like if a child with fever comes with convulsions, febrile convulsions, due to a high rise in fever, or fever causing hypoxic brain damage, or fever is because of sunstroke. In that case, reduction of fever proper is justified. So, if there is a high possibility of complications due to fever per se, only then one may seriously attempt to reduce it by artificial means. The age-old practice of tepid water sponging, not cold water sponging, it is tepid water sponging in fever is quite safe and equally effective even in 2012. And even in hospitals, we use this instead of giving any other drugs. So I think that you should adopt that first if you have ever to decrease fever. In the homeopathic parlance, we have very effective acute remedies to reduce fever artificially, which if required can be given in high potencies. Hence the need for analgesia or the antipyretics, allopathic antipyretics, is not necessary for conscientious homeopaths. So I don't advocate reduction of fever by allopathic drugs.
May I ask a question about looking up such a thing in Sensations as If? Would we find remedies for dealing with fever in Dr. Roberts' book, A Repertory of Subjective Symptoms?
Yeah.
Would we look under had, because it's based on chapters, the different parts of the body, like head, mind,
Covered.
So I'm just trying to see where I would maybe find something as an example for those who are just new to this, that they would look up, let's say, head, and I guess if you had a fever, there's one here that says beat head to pieces because of she could beat her head to pieces because of throbbing.
So that is accompaniment of fever. I mean, fever accompanied with headache.
Okay.
And that the particular sensation she is getting, that is beating her head. Like, for example, in Atramur, you have got sensation as if the hammers are hammering the center of the head. Or in Kali Bikram, you have got fever associated with headache and blurring of vision. So you can get those accompaniments. But we were basically essentially talking about reduction of fever. Should we use allopathic drugs? Or we allow the patients to use allopathic drugs? Well, I don't think so. If at all it is required, in homeopathy also, we have got excellent remedies and we make use of them day in and day out.
Yes. This is fascinating.
Yes. But basic question is whether you should reduce fever or not, number one. And second, why not give the human body the time to reduce fever? It's because ultimately if you have any object and you have to sterilize it, you have to boil it or you have to increase the temperature surrounding it. Only then you can sterilize it. So same mechanism, the same analogy applies for fever also. The body is trying to sterilize itself by increasing its core temperature. So if this is the fighting mechanism of the body, if we artificially reduce it, we are actually going against the body's defense mechanism. So we are weakening our own body system, defense system. We have no right to do so.
This makes sense to us. Yes, it does. And I'm also thinking that this might sound strange, but in another culture, the color white, they have many, many different words for the color white, where we might just have one word. And in the homeopathy, the same thing. There is a fine tuning of the human individual that when they are in the state of fever, they have their own particular mechanism and way of expressing themselves. So here in this book that Dr. Roberts writes, I have found in just the generals that a person might say that I feel as if my whole body is enveloped in cold, damp clothing, probably from the sweating. And then there is remedy that is associated with that, which is happens to be Veratrum album, which would be okay. Something good for fever. And
it's an excellent remedy for fever associated with diarrheal disorders like cholera and all.
And I'll just give one more example, because I really do find it so fascinating that when people are speaking their language, that they're expressing what they need that we can look up. It's been documented. Another one, a person says she had been drenched with hot water. And there's two remedies associated with that, calcarea carbon pulsatilla. So if a person is like has a huge fever and is sweating, that's something that they might express and say, this is how I feel. And then we have remedies to help them move that fever through.
Exactly. Like, for example, in Melilotus, you have got a strong urge for having bathing in ice cold water. The patient really feels he has a sensation or he has a sensation. So we should respect all those statements which come around with fever and or any sort of pain. In modern medicine, we just discard it. We only see for the symptom. But in homeopathy, we give a great deal of importance to these subjective narration to the fevers, or for that matter, the particular symptom which is in question. And these are very, very important, because for a particular symptom, we may have at the most 300 to 400 medicines which to select. These are precisely these statements, like I want to get wet in cold water, or I want to just lie down on the floor. These symptoms help us to choose the particular remedy for that ailment of the many.
Wonderful. Okay.
One more second question is from Dr. Josh London, and he says, in your hospital, which medicine is given for uterine inertia and cervical dystocia? Quick answer to this. Well, when the patient is not in labor, she has no uterine contractions even if post-dated. Then it is called as uterine inertia. That is, the muscle has gone into inertia. Whereas, when the patient is in labor, that means the true labor pains have started, and the internal os, or the cervix, has yet not dilated, or is dilated, but it's very partially dilated, then it is called as cervical dystocia. In medical parlance, we call it cervical dystocia, that is partially undilated cervix, and uterine inertia, that means no, in spite of the time coming, yet no initiation for labor pains. So in case of uterine inertia, at the hospital we start pulsatilla 1 mL every 2 hourly in fractional doses, and increase the doses as the labor pains set in. For cases of cervical dystocia, we administer gelsemium 6, 10 drops every hourly, and in cases of vomiting with cervical dystocia, we need to give Nux Formica 200, and we have seen excellent results. So this is practically daily practice whenever we get such patients. Repeat again, uterine inertia, it is pulsatilla 1 mL, it's cervical dystocia to dilate, gelsemium. I think I've made my point.
Good.
And now we shift on to the subject proper. The last time the chest chapter, we had discussed about discharge from the nipple. We had said something about discoloration and specifically spoke on hemochromatosis, iron overload, bronze diabetes, and then distension of the mammy. And finally, we come to dropsy. The other two we have to skip, drawn toward back feels, because it's a feeling. So we can't say anything about the feeling, and drops or sea falling, that also we can't discuss. So we come directly to a very, very interesting topic, and that is dropsy. Dropsy or edema, if you can go through the slides which I've prepared. It's self-explanatory. Dropsy or edema or edema, OEDEMA or EDEMA, or hydropsy is an abnormal accumulation of fluid beneath the skin or in one or more cavities of the body that produces swelling. The Middle English dropsy, D-R-O-P-E-S-I-E, came through the Old French hydropsy, and that is again derived from Greek hydrops, which in turn came from ultimately water, that is hydro. So here we have got the origin of the word dropsy. As a clinician, I would like to classify these, because lots of reasons for dropsies are there, although the drugs here given are limited, but lots of, so we have to understand basically dropsy, what it is, and that is why broadly, clinically, it is classified as a pitting type of edema or a pitting type of dropsy and a non-pitting type of dropsy. Pitting, I will say edema, because this is the present colloquial term used for dropsy. Dropsy is an old English terminology, henceforth never used in modern parlance. So, pitting edema is moment you apply the pressure, after a pressure is applied to a small area. For example, the commonest area where we look for pitting is the shin of the tibia. And you press it in such a way that the blanching of the finger is there. Only that much pressure is to be given. So after the pressure is applied to that small area, and if an indentation persists for some time after the release of the pressure, then it is called as pitting edema. So peripheral pitting dropsy is the more common type. It's resulting from water retention because of various causes. And generally, whenever you have a pitting edema, you think of some systemic disease, not some local diseases. Pregnancy in some females, heart diseases or heart failure, nephrotic syndrome, varicose veins, thrombophlebitis, insect bites, all these can cause pitting edema. The non-pitting edema is observed when the indentation does not persist. It may be again associated with generalized conditions like myxedema. Myxedema means severe hypothyroidism. M-Y-X-E-D-E-M-A, it's called severe hypothyroidism. Then lipoedema and lymphedema. Lymphedema is again very common. It is it occurs because of disorders like filariasis or malignancies. Post-malignancies, it can occur after radiotherapy. There are many causes. We'll go that. And one interesting thing is dropsy due to malnutrition. Whenever the person is malnourished or the child is malnourished, then we expect the child to be very thin, lean, emaciated, like typical Abrodynum type. But in such cases, we find a child which is swollen completely, and that is a bad prognosis. Then this ailment or this sickness is called as kwashiorkor.
Can a person recover from that?
Of course, yes. But you can't give only medications. You have to actually give nutrition to the patient.
They're missing their nutrition to keep alive, and it's not just a drug. You need to be fed proper.
Exactly. The maximum the drug can do, for example, the most important drug for kwashiorkor is Abrodynum. And even if you administer Abrodynum, the only thing Abrodynum can do for you is, once the nutrition is provided, it can cause easy assimilation. Now, what happens is, since you have raised this question, many people who see such children starving and all in a pathetic situation, many doctors also, they would try to give nutrition with a great force. With great
Too much.
Yeah. So what happens in such a situation is that the child who has been malnourished for quite some time, the intestine fails to accept that nutrition in one go. So if you force upon the child too much nutrition at one point of time, then the child keeps on having loose motions or vomiting. So again, you have lost the entire purpose. Likewise, even if you give forceful IV, intravenous intravenous fluids or intravenous amino acids or intravenous lipids, you can give them. If you increase them, then again it causes cerebral edema and kills the child. So you have to be very cautious. Although you have such a child of kwashiorkor, or even an adult having kwashiorkor or marasmus, you have to correct the condition, but slowly. The person does not die. The person, human organism is quite an adaptable body. You can see millions of these people of kwashiorkor in Somalia and other African, Discovery Channel, if you see, day in and day out, they keep on showing such malnourished children of kwashiorkor. But even if these people need to be handled, they need to be handled with care, because the dropsy is a very, very important consideration. It shows that it is an adaptation of the body. The blood has completely come out and the serous fluid has filtered out and is collected in the subcutaneous spaces. So to shift them, you have to be quite careful when you're handling such people. So it is a broad classification of dropsy, pitting type and non-pitting type. Now, why do we have got generalized dropsy? Generalized dropsy means generalized edema. Now, first reason is a rise in hydrostatic pressure. Hydro means water, static means stasis. So hydrostatic pressure, if it rises, increases, that is inside the blood vessels, for example, as occurs in cardiac failure. Whenever the heart fails, the heart muscles fail, whenever the ejection fraction or the pumping capacity of the heart goes below 30%, we call it heart failure. In such situation, the entire pressure inside the vessels keep on rising, particularly both in the arteries and the veins, and the fluid oozes out of those capillaries, collecting in the interstitial space. Normally, the fluid should be in the blood form and it should circulate. But because of the failure of the heart to pump, the blood stagnates it does not stagnate, but undergoes stasis, and it slowly oozes out and collects where it should not collect, and that is in the interstitial space, causing generalized dropsy. Second reason is fall in the osmotic pressure. Now, osmosis. See, whenever you have got a fluid compartment with a greater density, and that density in human bodies is produced because of proteins. So whenever we have got high protein liquid in one chamber and a low protein liquid in another chamber, then the chamber in which there is low protein, the fluid will be sucked inside the high protein chamber. That is a principle of osmosis. Now suppose if you have a patient of nephrotic syndrome or renal failure, or you have a patient of liver failure where the protein production is hampered. In this situation, the blood protein level decreases, and thereby you have got the fluid from the vessels is sucked off and collects outside the interstitial space, and thereby we have got generalized dropsy. Then
many times generalized dropsy can cause edema in multiple organs. For example, once congestive cardiac failure occurs, then you can have fluid collecting in the lung cavity, you can have pulmonary edema, you can have fluid collecting in the pleura, you can call it pleural effusion, fluid collecting in the peritoneum, you can call it ascites, and generalized just below the skin, you can see peripheral edema. Again, nephrotic syndrome is because of not only this reason, that's fallen osmotic pressure, it is again because of biochemical and structural changes in the basement membrane of capillaries. See, glomeruli is the basic organelle of the kidney. Kidney consists of about 1.2 million glomeruli. And each glomeruli is supplied with an artery. And that artery is called afferent artery, that is supply artery, and efferent artery, that is the artery which goes away from the glomeruli. Now, whenever nephrotic syndrome or such diseases of the kidney takes place, the basement membrane of those capillaries supplying the blood, they undergo a biochemical change and structural change. This results in increased permeability and leads to protein in the urine. That's when normally the body will always conserve protein. It will not let the protein from the blood go into the urine. So that is why in such situations, if the membrane is destroyed, protein can escape, and that is why you got albuminuria or proteinuria, and thereby this leads to generalized dropsy. Again, generalized dropsy, many females you can see in many pregnant females. Now, pregnancy, particularly in the second trimester or the third trimester, you can have for females who are complaining of high blood pressure, that is pregnancy-induced hypertension, or preeclampsia of pregnancy, what we call. And if these females already have prior history of pulmonary problems or lung problems or poor circulation, or if they're taking drugs for arthritis, then this adds fuel to the fire and dropsy increases. Secondly, dropsy during pregnancy is found in lower part of the leg, usually from calf downwards. The upper part is basically free. Now, there's a very interesting term. I don't know whether you have heard about something called epidemic dropsy. This, what we were talking about, is dropsy in an individual patient, a generalized dropsy in an individual patient. But then there is a form of epidemic very well recognized in medicine, and that is called epidemic dropsy. And it results from the use of edible oils, adulterated edible oils, and the adulteration is because of an oil called as Argemon Mexicana. Argemon Mexicana is a seed which can be converted into oil form, and if you are adulterated eating oil, the edible oil, with this, then you have something called as epidemic dropsy. Now, this Argemon Mexicana, it contains two major alkaloids called sanguinarin, which is a homeopathic drug, sanguinarin and dehydrosanguinarin, and these, once they enter the capillary circulation or the circulation in the body, they cause widespread capillary dilatation. And moment the capillaries become dilated, they lose their structural integrity. Moment they lose their structural integrity, then there's a leakage of protein-rich plasma. The plasma actually should stay with the blood, but leaves the blood and collects in the extracellular compartment, and thereby the person gets generalized dropsy or edema. But this is not only edema, it does not restrict itself to edema. It also causes lowering of BP, that is hypovolemia. And you can have GI symptoms like nausea, vomiting, loose motions, skin rash, pigmentation of the skin, a cough, which is a typical short barking cough. This is a particular cough which you get, and there's shortness of breath, breathlessness, and ultimately, over a period of hardly 4 to 5 days, people may land up with right-sided congestive cardiac failure if they are not treated properly. And if the patient still persists, if the patient is still alive, then concomitantly, over a period of 2 weeks, you can start getting anemia, hypoproteinemia, ultimately acute renal failure, and probably death. Unfortunately, there is no specific therapy. So, what you can do is symptomatic treatment of congestive cardiac failure or the respiratory symptoms if you have got. One of the very, very remarkable drugs to be used in such cases is antimony ARS.
You have to use it very, I mean, it takes care of the congestive cardiac failure, it takes care of the respiratory symptoms, it also takes care of dropsy. So antimony ARS is a very good drug used if ever you get a case of epidemic dropsy, as far as homeopathy is concerned. Now this admixture of adulteration oil is generally done with mustard oil. People who eat mustard oil, because we have a lot of North Indians, they relish mustard oil and they eat mustard oil, food cooked in mustard oil. And this Argemone Mexicana oil is easily mixed with mustard, yellow mustard. So actually it should be it's a punishable offense, and the FDA, they should act. There have been instances where a lot of adulterated oil has been caught. But if ever we get such cases, then we should remember antimony ARS.
Thank you very much. That was really fascinating. And so is it by accident that it gets adulterated when they're
No, it's definitely not an accident. It's offense. I mean, a penal offense. People actually do it.
It's intentional for what
reason?
Yeah,
it's intentional.
For not to intentionally hurt people, but because it's less expensive to use this...
Argemone Mexicana is a simple weed which no one uses. So if you, and it grows along side of mustard plants. So if you have a farm where mustard is grown, you Argemone Mexicana goes as weeds. So if you, instead of clearing weeds, you use those weeds, but not realizing that although they are cheap, but it causes lots of problems. I mean, the entire families can be affected, and they get themselves killed by just because of this admixture.
Uh-huh, okay.
And this has happened in the past. And many states in India where poverty is galore, where people have done this, and many lives have been risked. So it's actually not only in India, but in Sri Lanka, or in Nepal, or in Bhutan, and Pakistan, Afghanistan, where mustard oil is tremendously used. I mean, it's used as daily diet. People cook food only in mustard oil. So there, Argemone Mexicana, this epidemic dropsy is actually of great risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the one remedy to use is the Antimonium Arsenicum?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I remember 10 years ago, I had seen a family of this epidemic dropsy. And there, at that time, my father had used this drug. Antimars, that's the only recollection. I've never seen such a patient of epidemic dropsy in my times. But I know, since I was in medical school 10 years ago, I know my father had managed two cases of that same family who had got this epidemic dropsy.
Mm-hmm.
So generally you tend to get such cases. And once you get, it's very difficult to strike. I mean, no one would come to you and say that I've eaten a particular oil and now I'm getting swelling. I mean, people conveniently forget what they've eaten and all. It's only the homeopath who keeps on poking about the history. What have you had in the last 24 hours? What oil? I mean, an allopath or other practitioner would not go in such details. Since we have the habit of asking and asking and asking, probably we may find out that it's an epidemic dropsy. Otherwise, it's very difficult.
That is quite true.
The moment you get such patients, it definitely would not strike you. You would always think of some heart ailment or some kidney ailment, and you proceed on those lines. See, it's very, very difficult to corroborate that because of that mixing of that oil, you have got such a patient.
Mm-hmm.
So, it actually, once you know, if you have a habit and you have only a suspicion, I remember my dad, every Saturday we have a clinical meeting, and clinical meeting is a joint discussion of a few other doctors who are like-minded, and it's such a great help. You can actually discuss cases, and one of the doctors came up with this hypothesis, why can't it be epidemic dropsy? And yes, then the entire cases, or both the cases were proceeded on those lines. Otherwise, when the patient had come, they were directly, although Antimars was still the drug, but no one could think of epidemic dropsy.
Mm-hmm. So you might come to the conclusion to use the proper remedy just simply based upon the symptoms that are presented without even knowing what was
cause.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are no investigations. See, if you do an investigation, if you have a congestive cardiac failure, now congestive cardiac failure can itself cause dropsy, and Argemon Mexicana oil can cause congestive cardiac failure leading to dropsy. So both of them can cause. So how do you know properly? And these people, the patients who come to us, they are so innocent. I mean, you can't expect them to tell you that they have had adulterated oil. Had they known, they would have never had.
That's true.
So theoretically, it's a very good entity, epidemic dropsy. But in practical or clinical, it's only if it strikes you ever that, yes, it seems to be epidemic, because more than one person or more than two people from the same family are suffering from exactly the same symptomatology of heart failure and all. So, yes, heart failure can occur only in one person, at the most two, but it cannot occur three and four people of the same family at the same point of time.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the time when you suspect that something is wrong with something generalized, like food item. And then you can think if that patient is poor or eating mustard oil, then possibly. So it's a diagnosis of exclusion. You rule out all other things, and if you don't find anything else, then you can go in for epidemic dropsy. Clinically, I'm speaking. I mean, it looks very good to hear about epidemic dropsy, but when patients come to us, it is not, I mean, you can't diagnose.
Okay.
Then, speaking about dropsy, it is not only generalized dropsy. We can have organ-specific dropsy. For example, cerebral edema or cerebral dropsy. Again, a very, very common event. People, they have known. Unfortunately, when you see the chapter of head rubric, you can have on page number 117, expanded sensation. In the chapter of head, you have a rubric called expanded, but unfortunately, second word given is a sensation. Then, again, page 117, you have
117.
Head expanded sensation.
Okay.
Second rubric is on page 118 and 119, fullness. Head fullness.
Okay.
And the third rubric you have got, page number 232, head swollen, distended feeling. Head swollen, distended feeling.
And tell me again how we jumped from the chest chapter over here to the head chapter.
Because we were speaking about cerebral edema.
Okay,
speaking about cerebral edema, and I wanted to tell the audience that there is no rubric, because all these three seem like rubrics for dropsy, but unfortunately, they are all sensations. Expanded is a sensation, fullness is a sensation, swollen, distended is a feeling, again a sensation.
Okay, so they're not applicable.
Yeah, at the face of it. But when you actually read the rubrics and you see the remedies, they are the same remedies for dropsy. So you can actually use them.
Okay.
Although they are sensations. So we were speaking about organ-specific dropsy. Cerebral edema is, again, the extracellular fluid accumulation in the brain. So basically, brain has a very, very small place to expand. It cannot expand. It is in the very, very thick, bony skull. So the moment you have got cerebral edema, you have really had it. It's a hell lot of situation. And the only treatment in modern medicine is diuresis. They give drugs for increasing the urine frequency and the urine volume. And secondly, what they do, if it is not working, then it connects a pipe, a plastic pipe, from the ventricles of the brain to the abdomen. And that is called as ventriculoperitoneal shunt or VP shunt. That's the maximum what people can do out in modern medicine. But in homeopathy, we have got very, very good drugs, which we will come around when we speak about cerebral edema.
Is this different from the people who have, like, get a drill in their head and relieve the amount of swelling and fluid in the brain?
Yeah, that is the same thing, no? That's the only thing you can do. That's at the most, you can only drill a hole in the head, release the fluid, but still the fluid keeps on accumulating. So what you do is connect that hole with the pipe, and that pipe is connected to the abdomen, the peritoneum. And peritoneum is a large space. So you can actually do not let your fluid be wasted. Instead, that same fluid flows down, because ultimately the fluid is derived from the own blood. So you can't keep on wasting the fluid and the blood and taking the patient dehydrated. So although the brain does not have place to advance, what we do is connect a pipe. But the biggest problem with that pipe is it gets blocked. Very, very often it gets blocked. So VP shunt is, and once it gets blocked, it again the entire pipe has to be removed and fitted back. So it's a great big surgery in itself. So again,
and also a chance of infection.
Yeah, that is always there. Whenever you have got any artificial things on your body, a pacemaker or a catheter or this VP shunt or a stent, there is always a chance of infection. That is always there. It's a foreign material, and how the body will react to the foreign material, first the body's reaction, and second, because it's a foreign material, bacteria or virus, bacteria can always grow. So that is always there. But the blockage is because of the clots inside. I mean, the fluid, if it gets clotted, then it blocks the shunt, and again, it leads to cerebral edema. So cerebral edema can occur in commonest causes, toxicity or abnormal metabolic states, like systemic lupus erythematosus. It's a rheumatoid arthritis. It's an the autoimmune disorders where we get cerebral edema. It causes drowsiness and loss of consciousness. Then second thing is, again, a very common clinical finding is pulmonary edema. That is edema in the lung tissues or dropsy in the lung tissues. Now this occurs when the pressure in the blood vessels, the blood vessels supplying the lungs, is raised because of obstruction. So whenever there's obstruction, when can an obstruction occur? It occurs in pulmonary artery hypertension. Pulmonary artery supplies the blood from the right ventricle to the lungs. If it is blocked, if it is sclerosed, then there's pulmonary hypertension and pulmonary edema occurs. Whenever there's left ventricle failure, when the ventricle, left ventricle particularly fails, or if you have gone, if you are living in on the plains and suddenly ascended to a high altitude, then you get altitude sickness. In such a situation, the lung vessels dilate profusely and thereby you get pulmonary edema. Or certain toxic chemicals like benzene or carbon monoxide, if you inhale them, particularly this happens in sewer gas people. I mean, people who have to work in the sewage canals and sewer gases. These people, if the mass is leaking, then they are immediately exposed to those toxic chemicals in the sewer gases and toxic gases, and that causes severe pulmonary edema. How do you know the pulmonary edema? The first symptom is shortness of breath. The person starts gasping, actually. Also, the patient's fluid can collect in the pleural cavity, and thereby we have got pleural effusions. And the commonest reasons for pleural effusions in India, unilateral pleural effusions or single-sided pleural effusion, is tuberculosis. And in older population, it is malignancy. If they have got cancer of the lungs, you can have pleural effusion. Then another area where very commonly you can find dropsy is in the cornea of the eye, and what is called as glaucoma. You have a rubric eye glaucoma, page 240. There is a rubric directly given as glaucoma. Glaucoma means raised intraocular pressure. Intra means inside, ocular means eye, and pressure means pressure. So raised intraocular pressure is technically called as glaucoma, and there are two types of glaucoma. We have got an closed angle glaucoma or a narrow angle glaucoma and an open angle glaucoma. Of course, I will not go into details what is narrow and closed angle, but generally it's a hereditary disease. If you have it in family, particularly females age around 40-45 years, nearing menopause, they tend to get glaucoma. Obviously, males also can get, but it is more predominantly a female disease. Once you get glaucoma, the pressure keeps on increasing, and you have to ultimately make a hole in the cornea and let the fluid out. We have got excellent remedies with homeopathy. One of the particularly important remedy is pilocarpine. Pilocarpus is a very, very important remedy for glaucoma.
Okay, we have folks who are listening. If anybody is there in the chat listening and you have questions or comments, just let Dr. Otto know that you're there and you're loving to hear what he's teaching us.
Then dropsy can also be found. See, many many people, when you look below the eyes, if they are wearing spectacles, if you ask them to remove the spectacles, you will see small bags of fluid below the eyelids. That is called as periorbital edema. Peri means around, orbits means self-explanatory, around the eyes. So periorbital edema is a very, very common occurrence. And generally we say, when you have got a periorbital edema, if you've got fluid above the lids, eyelids, then generally it can be of renal origin. If there is fluid below the lids, then you have a cardiac origin, cardiac problem or a heart problem, and you have got throughout the lids, I mean both above and below the lids, swelling is there, then you can have a liver problem. It is not a surety, but it gives an idea to a clinician. So also, there is something called as trio of dropsy, and you have got kalikab, you have got apis, and you have got phosphorus. If you have got edema or dropsy above the lids, then it's called apis is the drug of choice. Below the lids is kalikab, and around the lids is phosphorus. So there's a trio, Nash's trio. Dr. Nash was a homeopathic physician. He has given many trios of pain, trios of edema. So this is one of his favorite trios: apis, kalikab, and phosphorus. And obviously, phosphorus is one of wonderful remedies for liver. Kalikab is an excellent remedy for heart, and apis is a wonderful remedy for kidney. So it's again excellency. So we have got puffiness.
Are they all good for diabetes? Because I do think about phosphorus for diabetes.
Yeah, excellent remedies for diabetes. Kalikab, well, all three are very, very good remedies for diabetes, and they are curative remedies for diabetes also, not only palliative. But many patients are cured of diabetes because of drugs like phosphorus or kalikab or apis.
And they need to change their diet. So listen to Dr.
Yeah.
Roberts.
And not Dr. Roberts, Dr. Franz Hartmann.
Oh, Franz.
Well, okay. So where do you get this? You get this rubric of dropsy around the eyes in the chapter of face. Swelling, page number 392.
Face swelling.
Yeah. You should have got it below the eyes, but then eyes you don't have. You have got this on the chapter of face, swelling, 392. Page number 392.
Okay.
Okay. So these are some of the organ specific dropsies. And I have given you two pictures. One is edema or swelling of the ankles and the feet, typical of nephrotic syndrome. That means a kidney failure patient. And the other is, you have got generalized edema above the lids, below the lids, surrounding, again a case I would think of severe anemia or cirrhosis, or it could be nephrotic syndrome. Two pictures I had given. Then we go on to, again, myxedema. Myxedema is caused by increased deposition of connective tissue. Now, myxedema means severe hypothyroidism. Uncontrolled hypothyroidism. Hyperthyroidism causes leanness, thinness, and loss of muscle mass and fat. Whereas myxedema is increased deposition of connective tissue and increased tendency of the tissue to hold water. Now, why this occurs is because in hypothyroidism, there is an increased production of a carbohydrate-rich molecule. I am not going to go into technical details of that molecule. So there are hydrophilic. Hydro means water and philic means love. So certain carbohydrate rich molecules love water. That means they attach themselves to water, and thereby water is retained and it is deposited in the tissue matrix. So there is a permanent state of swelling in such patients. So myxedema, whenever you see a myxedema patient, there is always a swelling, and this swelling will be non-pitting type, or this dropsy will be a non-pitting type of dropsy. Myxedema, again a very common occurrence. Then we have got lymphedema. Abnormal removal of interstitial fluid is caused by failure of the lymphatic system. See, the basic reason, you always have a blood system, that is circulatory system of arteries, veins, venules, capillaries. Then you have a second system which is called lymphatic system. So the reason for lymphatic system is to remove interstitial fluid.
the fluid which is collected in the interstitium, it goes in the lymph, and from the lymph vessels it goes to the veins, because the lymphatics are connected to the venules. Suppose if the lymphatic system is abnormal or if the lymphatic system is obstructed, then the fluid around the lymphatic vessels is not absorbed, and thereby you have a permanent edema or dropsy, which is called as lymphedema. It can be because of pressure from a cancer. For example, if you have got a breast cancer. Now, the breast cancer can be so big so as to compress the surrounding lymph vessels. Moment the lymph vessels are compressed, then the fluid around the breast will not be absorbed by the lymphatic vessels and keeps on collecting, and thereby you can have a right arm or the left arm which is very, very huge and swollen. Same way with enlarged lymph nodes. For example, we have got lymphomas. They are malignancies of the lymph nodes, Hodgkin's lymphomas or non-Hodgkin lymphoma. In such cases, in both lymphomas or in leukemias, blood cancers, the lymph nodes can be so enlarged to such a great extent, and they can become stony hard or very hard, and they give pressure or they exert pressure on the lymph vessels. The moment they do so, they actually destroy the lymph vessels, and the fluid is not absorbed, and the local fluid keeps on collecting, and thereby we get lymphedema.
Can the lymph nodes and the lymph vessels be repaired in some way?
No, they can't be repaired in some way. Once destroyed, they are destroyed forever. And one of the commonest reasons of destruction is radiotherapy. Radiotherapy, whichever malignancy you take, they actually destroy the lymph vessels, because lymph vessels are very, very thin and feeble vessels, and they can't stand the radiotherapy at all. So the doses required for radiation, they actually destroy the lymph vessels, and that is why it's very, very common to get local edema or local dropsy of the affected part which is given radiotherapy.
And what about the concept of growing new lymph vessels?
No, that is, I mean, that is again, I mean, basically it's not possible. Angiogenesis is possible. That means blood vessels can grow, but lymph vessels, once destroyed, they don't grow. So you don't have lymphogenesis. You have never a term lymphoangiogenesis. Angio means a vessel. So lymphangiogenesis is never a term not known in medical parlance, but definitely angiogenesis or neoangiogenesis, new vessel formation, is very well known. We have a lot of arteries forming day in and day out, and that is how tumor survives. Any cancer has to survive by neoangiogenesis. It creates new vessels, and those vessels pierce and suck off blood from the surrounding tissues, and that is how the cancer grows.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the coronary artery disease, when the coronaries are blocked, it's the nature's attempt to create a natural bypass. How it does so? Suppose if the block is at a particular place, so just proximal or just before the block, new vessels start forming. So the body, the vital force, makes all attempts so that the heart should survive, the blood flow should circulate, should go on, and circulation should take place. What are homeopathic medicines like Sumbul or Terminalia Arjuna do? They actually enhance this new angiogenesis. So we are actually helping the body create a natural bypass, because that natural bypass takes more than 1.5 to 2 years. In some people, it may not progress that well. So homeopathic medicines actually enhance them. And that is how, even with triple vessel disease, that means all the three vessels, coronary artery, arteries getting blocked, you have got patients who are up, above and walking. They have not done their bypass. They have not done the angioplasty. Still, they are functionally very viable, and they are ticking about for years together. Now I've got patients who are 10, 12, 14 years with me, and they are perfectly well, no symptoms at all, of homeopathic and allopathic medicines both, for pretty long time. So, that's a subject by itself, so we are not going to that. We are actually discussing lymphedema. And
well, I'm very interested in this lymphedema and the care of the body organ and how to maintain health when the proteins are not being removed and there's blockages and there's swelling, how to keep it maintained and reduced.
Yeah, we have got medicines, for example, in filariasis. Now, filaria, I don't know, the West has never, don't get cases of filaria, but in India,
filaria is because of a parasite from a mosquito bite, Wuchereria bancrofti. Wuchereria bancrofti is a parasite, and once the mosquito infected mosquito bites, slowly and steadily, the Wuchereria bancrofti rests in its favorite place, and the favorite place is lymphatic vessels. So, moment the lymphatic vessels, parasite goes, it accumulates, multiplies, and dies. And once it does so, it creates a blockage, and the entire lymph vessel is blocked, and thereby causing lymphedema. So much so that you have an elephant-like foot, or what is called as elephantiasis. Very, very common sight in India, and throughout Indian subcontinent, involving Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Indonesia, all those places, we have got lots of cases of elephantiasis and the lymphedema. Unfortunately, we have got no medicines to decrease those that elephant-like foot. Not even surgeries help. So people have to, till today at least, they have to stay for a pretty long time or throughout their life with such condition.
And so,
what we can do is,
yes,
that limb, say the upper limb or the lower limb, whichever is infected, that becomes very hard over a period of time. So the person is unable to function with that limb, very difficult to walk. So it looks ugly because it's already swollen, it's consistently swollen. On top of it, you get pain, you have got heaviness, and you have got a particular type of tightness. So with certain drugs like Lapis Alb, L-A-P-I-S, Lapis Alb, like Sister Scan, like with these drugs, you can decrease the tightness and you can increase the flexibility of that particular limb. That is at the most you can do. You can actually cannot decrease the fluid which is collected because the lymphs are actually destroyed and blocked completely.
What was the first remedy that you mentioned?
Lapis Alb, L-A-P-I-S, Lapis Album.
Okay.
And second is Sister Scan.
Okay.
So these two drugs basically primarily act on the nodes, but they also act on lymphatic channels, and they also act on the entire fluid retention and make it somehow soft. I don't know. I have no pathological explanation of how those remedies act. But definitely, some patients do demand, "Doc, please give me medicines so at least I may be able to function. Let the edema remain. Let the dropsy remain. But at least I should be able to walk. It should not pain." So how to reduce that pain? We frequently use either of those two remedies in very low potencies for a period of time. And one of the very important remedies that I have been using quite frequently for such patients is stigmata medis. Stigmata medis, S-T-I-G-M-A-T-A, stigmata medis, M-A-D-Y-M-A-Y-D-I-S. A very, very effective remedy used in mother tincture form, and it definitely causes much reduction in the dropsy of that lymphatic destroyed lymph node, limb.
Okay, this has been very educational today. I don't know how far we have gotten along. For the folks who are listening, we have a bunch of people on the chat today. And if you have any comments or questions, especially for future shows, we're here on Wednesdays at 11:30 Eastern Time, USA. And we do welcome your calls. I haven't even been checking to see if somebody has called into the show, but I don't see anybody now. We appreciate when you share on Twitter, put a tweet up for your friends to listen on Facebook, on StumbleUpon, MySpace, wherever you are on your social networks. You can also take the HTML code to embed the show if you'd like to have it on your own webpage. Dr. Otto, do you have any farewell words today for those who are listening to you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, see, dropsy is a very, very common subject, and loads and millions of people are suffering. And unfortunately, see, all pathies don't have, or rather, very, very few remedies are available for this particular symptomatology. Homeopathy has got loads of remedies, and we will be speaking on them in the next show. We have not spoken anything about the remedies as of yet. We have only been speaking about the types and the mechanisms causing the dropsy. But we will be speaking about the medical mechanisms, and you can use them. and you will be benefited, I'm sure. But use them in consultation with your homeopath. Use them in consultation with a person who knows about these drugs. The potency is important. The drug is important. The repetition is important. And slowly and steadily, you'll feel a great sense of relief and cure, possibly, of your ailment. With these few words, I would end this show. And again, we'll resume it because we have not finished as yet with dropsy. And we will be resuming this same subject next time.
Excellent. I want to thank everyone for listening. And tomorrow, we're going to have Greg Glazer on and Alan Phillips talking about vaccinations and your rights in the United States. There's a lot to talk about, a lot of legislative action and changes in the tenor of our environment today for freedom of health and choices. And we would love to have you call in with your questions to that show as well. On Monday, we have the Health In. We'll be finding out that's at 11 a.m. on Monday Eastern Time. So thanks, everyone, for listening. I'm going to close the show with the exit song, and I might start up again in a minute just to talk a little bit more about Dr. Roberts and what he has to teach us. So,
wow. So before before we end, I would like to quote Mr. Richard Batch. He says, "Don't be dismayed by goodbyes. A farewell is necessary before you can meet again. And meeting again after moments or lifetimes is certain for those who are friends." So I believe all our friends would meet up next Wednesday, same time.
Sounds good to me. Okay, bye-bye, everyone. Thank you so, so much for being here.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.
Creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. From time to time, we will have a special presentation on a variety of topics. Homeopathy is a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook. Please contact HWC if you would like to help support the show as a sustaining member, or have suggestions for future shows. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Please share by tweeting on Twitter, posting on Facebook and MySpace, and all other social networks. You may select the widget and place the player on your blog or website. With gratitude to all our listeners, let's go!
Hi, this is Debbie Brock again. We're going to continue today's session talking about the principles and art of cure by homeopathy, which is what we love to use as our first choice in medicine. This is written by Herbert Roberts, MD, And last week I also read one of the chapters from his book because it is significant and educational for each and every one of us to go back and review the philosophy of homeopathy and understanding why we're using it and why we love it. I also want to make a mention that if you go to homeopathyworldcommunity.com, which is the platform where we host all of these events, shows, blogs, and provide a space for homeopaths around the world to communicate and interact with each other and also to share their knowledge, that we have many great things going on. Miranda Castro has provided a discount code to her many products on her website for, let's say, if the winter is coming up, you want to keep the lips moist. There's a wonderful 7 cream that's made with some luscious honey and other good things, that nothing that can harm you, no petroleum or other chemicals. It's very popular. We also have Mary Aspinwall's Homeopathy World Kits and Remedies. And she's got beginner kits, intermediary kits, special kits for pregnancy, for labor, for those people who are midwives or medical physicians who want to get involved with homeopathy. Those kits are great to have at your office or clinic. Also, there's a link for the Complete Dynamics in Homeopathy computer program, so that as we're talking throughout our shows and we mention authors, master homeopaths, that we have references to their works in the Materia Medica. We also have the ability to look up the rubrics, as we do today. When I pull out my book of Kent Repertory, we're looking up the little rubrics that tell us what the symptoms are in the different chapters. And Complete Dynamics has a wonderful program at a very, very reasonable cost that can be at your desk, on your desktop, at your fingertips, every single day to look up these items of interest and begin your study that way. We also have a link to Kaviraj, who is a homeopathic agro farm and garden organic gardener, and he's been doing this research and study for so many years and has written a popular book, Homeopathy for Farm and Garden, and that's for those folks who want to keep their garden organic. So we've got lots and lots of resources, and the last one I wanted to mention today was Kavitha Kukunoor, who is a homeopath and an inspirational author, and she has written her life story of being a homeopath physician in India and moving to America and how she transitioned. And the last thing, we have Grant Bentley and his homeopathy facial analysis method, which is a fabulous addendum to the way that you work and looking at the structure of the face. And we're going to go ahead now and read from Chapter 7, and it's all about our remedies and why they act. Dr. Roberts says, in our thesis that homeopathy is fundamental, that it is scientific, and that it is based on natural law, we have quoted findings from other branches of pure science that have been so uniform and constant as to definitely point the way toward underlying laws. These, to capitulate briefly, were toward underlying laws. These are astronomy, mathematics, and biology, and have been compared with the closely similar findings of the action of drugs and their application, one, in states of health to produce artificially conditions simulating disease, or two, to restore disease states to the normal balance of health. And Dr. Adil, in his last hour, had mentioned how fever is a naturally occurring method for the body to dispose and clear of foreign matter, bacteria, viruses, by raising the temperature and killing off those diseases, those foreign matters in the body. And so using the homeopathic remedies, we can artificially also induce that curative power. And we go back and listen to the last hour if you want to find out what I mean in that respect. And then the part two, he says, is to restore disease states to the normal state of balance. And that a lot of people might call homeostasis. So Dr. Roberts continues, let us consider once more some of our deductions set forth in former chapters on, quote, vital energy in its universal application, unquote, that we may have it before us for examination in comparing our deductions from other branches of scientific investigation with our study of the natural laws underlying the principles adapted for use in the science of healing known as homeopathy. We shall quote from this chapter. These substances capable of being raised by potentization are derived from three kingdoms, mineral, vegetable, and animal. We cannot definitely say that the mineral substances in themselves possess vital energy, but they are fragments of that which composes the planet, Earth, and that planet either possesses some form of vital energy in itself or is susceptible to being activated by vital energy to such an extent that it performs its appointed movements according to the law. And we can use these minerals by proper preparation in the form of vital energy, not to perpetuate life, but to influence it on all three planes of body, mind, and spirit, that the vital energy of the individual may be therefore and thereby guarded against decay and death. We recognize the presence of vital energy in vegetable growth, for it is evidenced in growth and development on the plant, according to the natural law of development. We comprehend most easily the animation, the presence of vital energy in the animal kingdom. It is quite within the province of the homeopathic physician, especially if he believes that homeopathy is based on the fundamental principles underlying all elemental construction and development, to attempt to understand something of the basis of the elements with which he has to deal, both in states of sickness and in health. This implies a knowledge of drugs, not only their action, but their derivation. And this not in superficial terms, but in terms of basis, derivation, and interrelation with universal construction. This deals with physics in a very definite way and in a much deeper, more constructive, and significant way than we usually consider. Now, I wonder if the pharmacies, I'm taking a pause to say some commentary, if I wonder if what Dr. Roberts would say today with the incident of 17 people dying from an injection of a contaminated steroid into their spine in order to reduce their pain, their back pain. People undergo this type of intervention, serious intervention, and there is a lot of investigation today about what is going on in the pharmaceutical environment, the world where small compound pharmacies are creating their own drugs, steroids in particular, which blocks the immune system from its natural course of action, its natural laws of action. And there is going to be repercussions from this. And keep your eye on the news. Dr. Roberts continues in his book, in this little book called Science and the New Civilization, the author Millikan gives us some valuable hints in his chapter on available energy. His statement in this chapter is that, quote, all knowledge that helps towards an understanding of the nature of the universe of which we are a part is useful, for we need very much more of it than we now have or shall have for centuries to come, to enable us to direct our energies towards wise, effective living instead of wasting them on beating tom-toms, inventing perpetual motion machines, or chasing either physical or social rainbows. I wonder what he's talking about there. Dr. Roberts says, if it be wise for the average person to direct their energies towards and understanding of things about them, how much more is it the province of him who is entrusted with the care of others through the use of drugs built up and potentized out of the elements? Let us consider further some of Dr. Millikan's statements in this chapter and their bearing on our specialty, quote Milliken. It is interesting and a very important fact from the practical viewpoint, too, that more than 95% of this universe, so far as we can now see, is made up of a very few elements. First, the spectroscopy of the heavens shows the enormous prevalence everywhere of hydrogen, but hydrogen is merely the primordial positive and negative electrons tied together or in process of being so tied. Second, the spectroscopy of the heavens also shows that helium is an exceptionally abundant and widely distributed element, even though because of its lightness and inability to combine with anything, even with itself, the Earth has not retained much of it. Significant it is, however, that the alpha particle given off by all the heavy radioactive elements is nothing but helium, so that it must have a certain prevalence on, even on, Earth in the structure of the heavier elements. And I want to make a comment here that we do have homeopathic remedies such as hydrogen and helium. Third, Dr. Milliken states, Dr. I.S. Bowen at the California Institute solved with consummate skill the half-century-old riddle of nebulium and has shown that the substance abundant throughout the heavens, giving rise to these mysterious spectral lines, is mainly oxygen and nitrogen. But oxygen alone constitutes 55% of the Earth's crust and about the same proportion of meteorites. Oxygen and nitrogen, then, which for our present purpose will be treated as one element since they have nearly the same atomic weight and will be henceforth listed under the name of the stronger brother, constitute the third extraordinarily abundant element. And it is to be noted that there are no abundant elements at all between helium and oxygen. Carbon has a certain minor nitrogen and oxygen. It may be here be treated as merely a feeble satellite to oxygen. Now, I'm not really up on all of this chemistry, but to me, carbon is very, very important in life, so I'm sure he must have something to say about that later on. Fourth, 95% of the weight of all meteorites consists of oxygen. That's 54%, magnesium, 13%, silicon, 15%, and iron, 13%. While 76% of the Earth's crust is composed of the three elements, oxygen, 55%, silicon, 16%, and aluminum, 5%. No other element rising over 2%. Iron constitutes 1.5% of the crust, but it is supposed to be very largely represented in the interior. Because of the closeness of their atomic weights, magnesium, aluminum, and silicon, that's 24, 27, and 28, may for our present purpose be regarded as a single element and given the name of the strongest brother, silicon. There are no abundant elements whatever between oxygen and silicon, nor between silicon and iron, with an atomic weight of 56. And from an engineering standpoint, the universe may be said to be made up of the primordial positive and negative electrons and of four elements built out of them, namely helium, oxygen, silicon, and iron. And so he's putting forth his theory of how he's grouping the different elements on the periodic chart and what composition they are in our Earth. Mankind, if he is here a billion years hence, will be satisfying his main needs as he satisfies them now from the four elements, hydrogen, oxygen, silicon, and iron. Example with water, air, earth, and iron, where the last symbol stands for iron rather than for fire, which was the fourth constituent of the world of these ancients. So he's brought together Chinese medicine into his theory here when we think about water, air, earth, and iron or fire. Dr. Roberts says, to comprehend the action of our remedies, it is well to look somewhat to the sources from which our remedies are derived and to weight their possible activity in their natural state. We regard the sources of drugs as lying in three distinct groups: animals, vegetables, and minerals. And we may make two classifications and say living and non-living. Sir J.C. Boss, in his book Plant Autographs and Their Revelations, writes, quote, "Do not the two sets of records of the living and non-living tell us of some property of matter common and persistent? Do they not show us that the same kind of molecular upset on stimulation occurs on both the inorganic and the living, that the physiological is closely connected with the physical, that there is no abrupt break, but a uniform march of law? The dust particle and the earth, the plant and the animal, are all sensitive. Thus, with an enlarged cosmic sense, we may regard the million orbs that thread their path through space as something akin to organisms, having a definite history of their past and an evolutionary progress for their future." And again, he states, "In pursuing investigation on the border region of physics and physiology, I was amazed to find boundary lines vanishing and points of contact emerge between the realms of the living and non-living. Metals are found to respond to stimuli. They are subject to fatigue, stimulated by certain drugs, and killed by poisons." And that is a quote from Sir J.C. Boss in Plant Autographs and Their Revelations. Dr. Roberts says, "For the purpose of convenience, however, we may divide drugs or substances from which homeopathic medications are prepared into the three classes of animal, vegetable, and mineral, or elements. We expect to find the highest form of living activity in animals. We have been taught to expect strong reaction to the various forms of defense of individual species of animal life. Thus, we find the venom of snakes has a deep action on other forms of animal life. We deduce that even when venom is prepared in minute reaction on animal life, Sir J.C. Boss has, and his name is spelled B-O-S-E, so it's either Boss or Bosey, has verified this in his experiments with the action of cobra venom, called nausea, on animals and plants. He found that in doses of 0.5 cc of solution of venom, one part in 1,000, when injected into the vein of a fish, the heart stopped beating in 12 minutes. This action was automatically recorded on delicate instruments. The same experiments was next applied to the plant. A solution of 1% was being used. A great depression was first recorded. Then the pulse beat came to a permanent stop. Then came wilting and decomposition. It is hardly necessary to go into the data available for further proofs of the activity of snake venoms. Our homeopathic provings preceded by many years of acknowledgement of the allopathic school that venoms in minute doses were exceedingly efficacious in many serious conditions, especially those showing great derangement of the vascular and nervous systems. The forms of defense, such as spider venoms, sepia, stings of bees and insects, and many other natural weapons, have been found effective in causing and treating bodily discomforts, may not be denied by those who have observed their action. And as a commentary, many native peoples have used these venoms on the tips of arrowheads to kill their prey because they are very effective in such a strong way. Quoting Dr. Roberts, thus, "We may pass on to a consideration of plant life as a source from which we may expect to derive useful remedies. We expect and find great reaction from all those growths which manifest in their natural states the power of protection through defense by poisonous properties. Thus, we find all members of the Rhus toxicondron family exceedingly active. that's poison ivy, poison oak, both in their crude state and in potentized form, affecting strongly the human organism in countless ways. The list of plants that strongly affect the human organism ranges through all forms, from the forms that approach the animal development in their power of capturing and devouring insects, such as the Drosera plant and the Sarracenacea purpurea, the lowliest and hardiest growths, such as Sticta pulmonaria, and is almost endless. To do more than glance at the long list of possibilities that open to the homeopathic physician through this source would be a task far too long for one chapter. We may take ourselves at once to the observation of those substances that may be most truly said to be non-living, yet which we must enter largely into the composition of the living, and that encompass us. Even more deeply acting than the venoms, we find the mineral and chemical elements. Plant life, through its power of simplifying these substances readily, form the closest relationship to the mineral kingdom. For here, the elements are often absorbed and made available for ingestion, them ingesting them even more active. Thus, we see the reasons for pulsatilla's strong action on the human economy. Dr. Underhill tells us that pulsatilla, the windflower, is one of the most effective chemical laboratories known, assimilating the mineral content and elements in the soil and rebuilding it into the most deep-acting and complicated influence upon the human organism. The most cursory glance at the chemical elements of our most common plant remedies must reveal how deeply bound these are to the chemical elements of light weight far below the atomic weight of those known to be radioactive, and these may be classed as those written of by Millikan, to quote again from the same source we have quoted previously in this discussion. Quote, Millikan, "For the great majority of the elements, such as constitute the bulk of our world, are in their state of maximum stability already. They can only be broken apart by working upon them, or by supplying energy to them. Man can probably learn to disintegrate them, but he will always do it, quote, by the sweat of his brow, unquote. But having thus disposed of the process of atomic disintegration and found it completely wanting as a source of available energy, since the radioactive elements are necessarily negligible in quantity, let us next see what there is to be learned about the process of atom building as a source of energy." Millikan goes on. He says, "The recent experimental work on cosmic rays have just thrown a flood of light on the process going on in this universe in which we live. For first, Dr. Cameron and I have recently found three definite cosmic ray bands, or frequencies, of penetrating powers, or ray energies, respectively, about 12, 50, and 100 times the maximum possible energies that are or can be obtained from any radioactive, that is, any disintegrating process. The highest frequency band has so enormous a penetrating power that it passes through more than 200 feet of water, or 18 feet of lead, before becoming completely absorbed, while 2 or 3 inches of lead absorbs the hardest gamma rays. This discovery of a banded structure in cosmic rays shows that these rays are not produced, as are X-rays, by the impact upon the atoms of matter of electrons that have acquired large velocities by falling through powerful electric fields. As we early suggested, the fields necessary to produce frequencies as high as those of the highest observed cosmic rays are equivalent to 216 billion volts. That's got 9 decimal placeholders, 260 billion volts, but that they are rather produced by definite and continually recurring atomic transformations involving very much greater energy chances than any occurring in radioactive processes. Taking Einstein's equation and Aston's curve as a guide, there are no possible atomic transformations capable of yielding rays of the enormous penetrating power observed by us, except those corresponding to the building up or creation of the abundant elements like helium, oxygen, silicon, and iron out of hydrogen, or possibly, in the case of the last two elements, out of helium. We have arrived at pretty definite evidence that the observed cosmic rays are the signals broadcast throughout the heavens of the births of the common elements out of positive and negative electrons. And that was a quote of Millikan on the physics of light, of cosmic rays, of energy bands, and it was a new discoveries at the time of their writings, where we have gone much further in our understanding and adding to the periodic chart and to the elements and to the powers of radiation and the destructive powers of radiation that we have today. And he is basically telling us, as he explained, using common plants, Drosera, Sticta, Pulsatilla, Rhus toxicondrin, all of these plants have very powerful means of absorbing and encompassing the minerals of the earth and utilizing them to our benefit, to life's benefit, because we then ingest the plants, of course, the ones that are foods and herbs, for retaining and getting to us the nutritional requirements of life and all of our vitamins and our proteins. And we can get these amino acids from our plant life as they absorb and utilize it. So when we take calcium, for instance, and we grind up some limestone and take pills, he's telling us, Dr. Roberts is telling us, that man is only using the sweat of his brow, but is not really disintegrating them. That's basically all he can do, chop them up into fine powder. But can they make it absorbable? Can they make it in a form that the body can really utilize? And that is why we must eat our plants. Dr. Roberts continues on to say, thus we find that in the birth of, say, two of our common earth elements, iron and silicon, we find tremendous powers liberated in the heavens. For convenience, Millikan in this article speaks of magnesium and aluminum as coincident with silicon because of their close atomic weights. We all know that effectiveness when energy is released by long titration and powerful succussion. So what he's reflecting upon here is that we, as homeopaths, when we use the potentization process of titration and grinding and the powerful succussion pounding, we're releasing this energy of these atomic particles, of these elements. And this is the way that we are energizing and absorbing this energy from the universe into our being. And this is what he's telling us is so important, how homeopathy helps us to heal and helps us work by providing what is absent or what is missing in the body, or as a similar, what is recognized in the body. Dr. Roberts says, chemical analysis of some of our common plant remedies reveals the presence of one or more of these common earth elements assimilated, broken into a form that supplies life energy to the plant. We find in a cursory examination of Lycopodium clavatum that has a powerful effect, that's club moss, it has a powerful effect upon animal tissue and animal energy when its powers are released by reducing it to the form of the homeopathic potency. Consider, I say, its profound effect after its assimilation by the plant, its energies there partially released for effective reaction, and that in turn undergoing a further breaking up and disintegration by the processes of titration and potentization. The history of Lycopodium may be of still further interest in giving us the reason for its effectiveness, and we as homeopaths know that this club moss, this Lycopodium plant, is one of the most ancient plants on the planet. Among the old forms of life, those forms which have existed longest upon the earth, we find the mosses. And of these, this family is a hardy member. It is probably one of the oldest living forms of earthy plant life that is dependent both upon soil and water. It has persisted past all changes in circumstances and conditions, and probably has changed its form less to meet changing conditions than almost any other form of life, except possibly the Equisetum, another of the early surviving forms. This tenacity of life, adapting itself to circumstances without conforming, bespeaks a tenacity of energy that, when released, must powerfully affect that which it touches. Equisetum hymenali contains silicon in the form of oxide and magnesium. In analysis, the amount of silicon may run from 7.5% to 41.2%. If, at their birth, these elements register such tremendous energy as the cosmic waves reveal, what effectiveness must we expect when it has been assimilated, broken down, first in plant life, and then by titration and potentization, even in minute quantities? When animal, vegetable, or mineral substances are potentized, they are rendered more potent because of the breaking up, disintegration of thin atomic relationships that place them in a form where they act directly upon the dynamic force of the individual. That is, in their disintegration, their energy is liberated by releasing the radioactive power. Through the radioactivity exerting itself upon the vital energy of the individual, the potency is made effective. Thus, we are forced to recognize different forms of energy, the discharge of different energies or rays from what we have considered as inanimate metals and elements. We find that they respond energetically in much the same way as plants and animals. Not alone in their simple states do we find this response, but again and again as they are assimilated, broken down, and rebuilt in different forms of life. From the simple assimilation and complicated rebuilding of the plant to the profound reaction on all living substances when they are in potentized form, we recognize that elements have high atomic weights, are radioactive. They give off spontaneously rays of different velocity and penetrating power, and in their radioactivity, their dissemination of energy, they are themselves changed. Einstein expresses this change when he says, quote, "The change of mass equals the change of energy. As they vary, energy vanishes with the mass, and so they are equal," unquote. And he's probably reflecting upon E equals mc squared, the famous equation for energy. Mass, he says, in this sense, does not mean bulk, as we commonly think of it. It is rather the sum total which gives off energy in some form is a part. As in mathematics, that which remains after subtraction is not as great as before. One cannot go on subtracting without coming to the end of that from which we should subtract. Thus, we see that uranium or thorium, after having discharged its rays for a long period, is so changed that we recognize it as radium. Radium, in turn, after exhausting a certain degree of its radioactive powers, becomes lead. For instance, we know that uranium, being the heaviest element, would be number 92 in the scale of atomic numbers, with an atomic weight of 238.14. Thorium, number 90, has an atomic weight of 232.12, and is so similar in some phases of its nature to uranium that it is also a source of radium. It stands in the atomic scale as 88, with an atomic weight of 225.97. Lead has an atomic number of 82, with an atomic weight of 207.22. The differing atomic weights of these substances demonstrate Einstein's statement regarding the change of mass equaling the change in energy. So we went from uranium, thorium, radium. So he explained how the heaviest element, uranium, and its number 92, had a relationship to thorium, number 90, to its relationship to uranium, thorium, and radium, and lead, which has a number of 82. Dr. Roberts says, we have spoken before of homeopathy and its relation to fundamental laws, and this chapter is an attempt to set forth further deductions on that basis. Thus, we comprehend that every step toward understanding of the working of the natural laws brings us to a clearer vision of a few basic cosmic laws, fundamentally few in number, but with a multiplicity of manifestations. The laws governing homeopathy are seemingly not closely associated with laws governing other forms of pure science. Yet the knowledge is born in us and born upon us that this is one manifestation of that which is basic. It differs only in its manifestation and not in its essence. We must teach ourselves to discriminate between the multiple manifestations or applications of the law through differing forms as they appear to casual observation and their essences, which are so closely similar as to lead us to question if they be not fundamentally identical. Sir J.C. Boss, from whose invaluable records we have quoted from time to time, quotes from ancient Hindu philosophy a throbbing, vital truth to which every thoughtful homeopathic physician can subscribe and that he must heed. Quote, they who see but one in all the changing manifoldness of this universe, unto them belongs eternal truth. Unto none else. And this is the end of today's reading from The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, written by Herbert A. Roberts, M.D., Chapter 7, called Our Remedies and Why They Act. In the end, he brings it all back to the number one, to this spiritual essence of everything is one. We are one. We are part of the universe. We are in harmony with the universe. And everything is undergoing transformation of energy. As the butterfly metamorphs and transforms and undergoes change through its processes of quiet periods and active periods, so too, he is telling us that the minerals, the elements of the earth, which seem to be simply inorganic, are also undergoing changes through its rays and elemental powers and energies that it was come into being from one, that we are now being able to detect these powers through technology, and that he was aware of it in his time and must have been quite amazed and awed by what he learned, and went to teach the students and the people who would listen about E equals MC squared and how it is connected to homeopathy, and how titration and potentization, succussion of simple minerals, elements, and plants and animal substances can transform and heal when there is disease. And he said that at the beginning. One, in states of health, to produce artificially conditions simulating disease, or two, to restore disease states to the normal balance. I hope that the listeners have enjoyed today's show. It was quite lengthy, two full hours, and It is enlightening to read this. And I would appreciate any comments and feedback. If you enjoy these types of talks, if you enjoy readings, whether you want them to be shorter, whether they're too long, or whether it's okay that you can archive them, you can download them, you can listen to them on your iPod, your mobile device, on your computer, and maybe reap some benefit as you listen over and over again to this type of discussion. So I'm going to end today's show. I want to thank you again for listening to Homeopathy World Community, for tuning in. We have on tomorrow, up at 12 noon, Greg Glazer, constitutional lawyer from California, and Alan Phillips from North Carolina, discussing vaccinations and your rights. On Monday at 11 a.m., the Health In Show goes live, video stream. And go to Homeopathy World Community to tune in and find out about all of those shows. On Wednesday at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim is our wonderful host and teacher about your health, and he does answer questions from around the world. So we're going to end with our song, Loving Homeopathy.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air, share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter, send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.
Homeopathy, 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 homeopathy.